I'm Mike Collins. Once the dust settles on the voting in Iowa and New Hampshire, the Democratic race for president heads south.
Make no doubt about it, the road to the White House starts in South Carolina.
The first in the South primary has been pivotal in picking Democratic nominees. Will that be the case this year? Join Charlotte Talks for a preview of the upcoming vote. We'll be at Winthrop University's DiGiorgio Campus Center Wednesday, February 12th at 7 p.m. Register to attend and find more information at wfae.org/charlottetalks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. 60 years ago, this past Saturday marked a significant anniversary in American history. On February 1st, 1960, a group of students from North Carolina A&T sat down at a Woolworth's lunch counter in Greensboro. It was the first course in a movement that changed America. That moment also changed those students, a group that has come to be known as the Greensboro Four, and one of them was Franklin McCain.
On February 1st, 1960, after I sat in for about 5 minutes, I had a sense of dignity, a sense of worth, and a sense of manhood, and to an extent that I had never felt in my life before. In fact, it was just overwhelming. And I had the real feeling that if life should have ended at that very moment, I would have had it all in terms of what life has to offer. I mean, that's how good I felt.
Franklin McCain is now the subject of a documentary centering on that event and the difference it made in America. It is the work of frequent documentarian Steve Crump, and he joins us now to talk about Franklin McCain, flashbacks and observations from a civil rights trailblazer, as well as another documentary about Congressman John Lewis, another civil rights trailblazer. Welcome back to the program.
It's been a while, and, you know, the two projects tended to overlap each other, and just very grateful that we were able to pull it all together and make it work.
Yeah, we'll talk about how you did that. We're also joined in our Spirit Square studio by one of the organizers and a participant in the Greensboro sit-ins, Dr. Herman Thomas, who is also Professor Emeritus at UNC Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you. Good to be here.
Good to see you. And to make sure that we cover all of the bases, we also have two of the people that Steve spoke with in the course of doing this documentary and who appear in this film. Tom Hanchett is an historian and in residence at the Carolina Room in the Public Library here in Charlotte. Welcome back.
Good to be on WFAE.
Well, good to see you. And Reverend Dr. Ricky Woods is Senior Minister of First Baptist Church West here in Charlotte. Welcome back to you as well.
Thanks, Mike.
I should point out that this documentary, the first one we're going to talk about, Franklin McCain, Flashbacks, Observations from a Civil Rights Trailblazer, will be screened tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock at Harvey B. Gantt Center and then aired on Bounce TV, which is...
And on WBTV.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, on the big channel.
On the big channel. The big side, yeah. On the 21st of February, and the John Lewis documentary is on Bounce. Is it also on BTV?
We're looking for a place.
Okay. At 7:30 on, I used a font that does not print out numbers. I just noticed
yeah,
this.
Yeah. The McCain piece is going to be 7:30 on BTV.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you have these two new documentaries coming out, Steve. How many does this make for you? You just keep cranking them out.
I don't know. I'm sure it's somewhere more than 20, you know.
Oh,
but,
my gosh.
Yeah. But there are things that you can say in the course of, you know, these are shorts. These are half hours. I've done the hours. But there are things you can say in that span of time that you can't cram into a minute 30 news story.
Right.
And have people think and walk away with a changed opinion or something like that.
So Franklin McCain is the man you're focusing on in the first film, looking at the lunch counter sit-in in Greensboro. And quite honestly, I've not heard his name before. And I think this is why this is important, this documentary. Four students are credited with taking part in this action, in this event. Why did you come to focus on Mr. McCain?
I call him Frank. He was...
I don't know him, so I'll call him Mr.
Okay,
McCain.
All right. Dear friend, he, you know, graduated with a degree in chemistry, worked locally here at Celanese, did a lot of things, even beyond the sit-ins. He was one of the people that organized the NAACP Legal Defense Fund dinners. You know, he and his dear, dear friend, Julius Chambers, I know you know that name. And Frank was oftentimes credited as being the ringleader and the student organizer that pulled it all together. And so Dr. Thomas will tell you that after February 1st, on the 2nd and the 3rd, and throughout that week, there was a groundswell of support on that campus where it was four guys one day, but by the end of the week, you know, you had lots of people showing up in that Woolworths. Yeah, there was some angst, and there were happened to be, you know, people that would show up with Confederate flags. But one of the many tenets that these students subscribed to was the philosophy of nonviolence. And that was something that worked out. Even though they were being harassed and, you know, lit cigarettes being dropped down their backs, milk being poured on their heads, they stayed the course.
Yeah, this was not a one-day-only event, as Steve just pointed out. This thing built throughout the week and then spread throughout the country, which we'll talk about. And Dr. Thomas, you were one of the participants. I think on day two, you went to the lunch counter. We just heard Franklin McCain in that cut that I played talk about how he felt that day when he walked into that lunch counter. He had been depressed about his treatment as a human being prior to that day, and he sat in that chair, and suddenly he says he felt like a man for the first time in his life. Do you remember what it felt like for you to sit in that chair the first day?
Well, I actually was a part of the group that started down the next morning. I think it was about 10 or 11 o'clock. Skipped my chemistry lab and went on to the march because that was the first day of classes. Mm-hmm. And I remember passing under the Market Street Bridge and saw the sun shining. And here we are going down to try to be a part of something. We really didn't know what we were going to be honest with
right.
you. We went down and literally sat in for a while. You didn't sit in all day. You sat in for a while, then you left, went to your class, did your homework, did those kinds of things, and then you scheduled yourself back in for the campaign. So it was not a spur of the moment kind of thing. It was structured because we had already had nonviolent training the night before in Scott Hall, and Dr. Woods knows where Scott Hall was. It's been torn down now. It was a 1,012 student residence hall.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt like that we were participating in something that was both fun because we really didn't know what
right,
we were getting into.
That's right, because it could have been very dangerous.
But in my case, and it gets very personal, I had already been participating in an attempt to desegregate a school in the state of North Carolina back in 1955.
Wow.
And so when I came into this, it was that all over again, but with a different outcome. We were successful in this instance, whereas in 55, in the mountains of western North Carolina, we had not succeeded.
No one had ever done this, I don't believe, before those four men walked in and sat down at the
It had game. Been attempted no. in Durham in an okay. ice cream stand a couple of years before, but this is the one that caught fire.
And the argument that they made that day, on that first day at least, was they had come in, these four guys had come in, and they started buying things like school supplies, things that you would need at a Woolworths. And I want to go back to that Woolworths because I looked at the menu that day, and boy, I want to go back to those prices. But
that would be nice.
But they bought things, and then they sat at the lunch counter, and they said, "We don't serve you here."
Mm-hmm.
Well, you do. We just bought these, and here are the receipts. You do serve us. That was their argument.
And we sat. We simply sat. You said nothing. You just sat. And that was what I think was particularly disturbing to the owners, that you didn't say anything to them. You just sat, waiting to be served. And I think that got to their heart, if
yeah.
they had one. And I think they did. You just sat. You sat quietly. You talked to each other, but you sat quietly.
Tom, this Greensboro sit-in led to others, of course, and it created, I'm told, a template for nonviolent protests going forward in the civil rights movement. Had there been no nonviolent protests up to that point?
There's an interesting history of this kind of protest that goes back to the 1940s at Howard University, Washington, D.C., where Thomas Weitch, who was a charlatan, Pauli Murray, who was from Durham, a whole bunch of folks went and protested at a cafeteria that would not serve African Americans right next to campus. And evidently from there, that idea spread. There was a sit-in at the Charlotte Airport in 1954. Trying to desegregate and succeeding in desegregating the lunch counters there. But what was special about Greensboro was folks like Herman Thomas and Franklin McCain. What they did was to turn it into a movement. It wasn't just, you know, students at one place. And I think part of that may have been the fact there were so many historically black colleges and universities across North Carolina interlocked through things like the CIAA athletic tournaments, the fraternities, the sororities. And so Charles Jones here in Charlotte, we at Levine Museum in the New South, there's video of him, also video of McCain, saying, you know, I was driving back from someplace late that night, that first night, and I heard about this, and I said, yes, it's the handle we need. Got the folks together at Johnson C. Smith, and pretty soon there was a sit-in movement at Johnson C. Smith.
So whose idea was this at North Carolina A&T? Was it Mr. McCain's idea? Was it a group of people's idea? And did you think of it at the time as a movement?
The origin of the thought of doing this had come from Frank McCain, Ezell Blair, David Richmond, and Joseph McNeil.
Those are the four, the Greensboro Four.
So they had just been sitting talking. And then they'd been in conversation with, and I think some books will bear this out, I just remember from having been there, with a dentist in Greensboro. I can't recall his name right now, but there had been some conversations with him and some others in the NAACP context in Greensboro. I believe that's right. But anyway, there had been some outside conversation. But aside from that, I think there was just a sentiment that it's time to do something. We need not continue this kind of segregated atmosphere that we had, both in our past experiences as well as in the city. And it's just time to do something.
I've read a bunch of stuff yesterday, and one of the things that I read, and I think that it was this sit-in and not another, I could be wrong, was that some little old white woman came up to one of the guys sitting at the counter. And,
true story.
And put her hand on his shoulder, and she said, "I'm disappointed in you." And he said, "Why are you disappointed in me that it took you this long?" Dr. Woods, you were a student at North Carolina A&T. You made a big deal out of that before
yes.
we started.
Aggie Pride.
Were you there at the time?
No, I came much later. That's part of our history and tradition. And I think one of the wonderful things about attending North Carolina A&T, knowing that story and knowing of the resistance movement of students, at the school, being involved not just in issues related to civil rights, but also issues related to anti-war protest and issues now related to environmental justice. So that tradition continues to carry on among the students on the campus.
So it continues to reverberate.
Yeah. Yes.
Is that also, though, because a lot of students today, I don't care who you are, or they don't know necessarily a lot of history, and we're in a position right now, at least, to have first-person retelling of some of this history through these documentaries and through people like Dr. Thomas, who's here with us today. And what does that mean to young people, do you think, to actually hear from the people who were on the ground?
It's hard to fully describe, Mike. I remember my first meeting of Franklin McCain once I moved to Charlotte almost 25 years ago now, and the impact that had on me, knowing his story, but meeting him and being able to talk with him firsthand and to talk to Julius Chambers firsthand, it makes that history come alive.
Yeah.
It also is great to have them to talk about what they see that you can do. And so it builds up your confidence because they were students just like you at one time and took that leap. But I do want to say something else that I think that's very important about this is not only were they engaged in protests, but they also were engaged in education. It's that combination of both them and the student. They took their schoolwork with them.
When we come back, I want to go back in time a little bit from and get Tom Hanchett to lay the groundwork for this, because there are a lot of people alive today who have no clue what this era was like. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Steve Crump's two new documentaries, which will air at the end of this month on the 21st and 22nd of February, both on Bounce and eventually on WBTV. Franklin McCain, Flashbacks and Observations from a Civil Rights Trailblazer, and John Lewis, Reflections of a Sit-In Pioneer. Steve Crump is with us.
And the Franklin McCain piece airs on WBTV 7:30.
Okay, so right after the Bounce.
No, two separate channels.
I know, but...
Yeah, but no.
I understand this. So let me explain to the people who don't understand it.
Two different nights, two different shows.
Okay, so the Bounce is a sub-channel of Channel 3, and you have to have a digital TV or cable or satellite to get it. All right.
1255 on Spectrum.
All right. Dr. Herman Thomas is also here. He's an organizer and a participant in those Greensboro sit-ins of 60 years ago on Saturday and the week that followed. Tom Hanchett is historian-at-large at the Carolina Room at the Mecklenburg County Library, and Reverend Ricky Woods, a senior minister at First Baptist Church west of Tom. We should not minimize the courage it took for these four young people, although it was peaceful. For these four young guys to walk in there on day one, they were putting their lives on the line. As peaceful as they were, as nicely dressed as they were, the fact that they were just sitting there doing their homework and wanting to get a Coke and fries, they were putting their lives on the line. A lot of people don't understand what segregation and Jim Crow was like, particularly in the South. Set the stage.
Everything was separate. The Supreme Court had said separate but equal was okay. They said that in 1896. Folks figured out the separate part real quick, but they never did get around to the equal part. The thing with the lunch counters at the Woolworth, folks today may not remember Woolworth, but if you think of Target or Walmart, there's that eating place in the front. Mm-hmm. And the way it was set up, and there usually weren't signs, you just had to know this, that if you were African-American, you could not sit down. You could order food to go, but you couldn't sit down. And so, you know, that was just the tip of an iceberg of really brutal inequality.
Yeah, it's
and it was really smart of these students. I think their youth was a key thing. Franklin McCain on the video over at Levine Museum of the New South says, you know, do not expect to get permission. You'll never get permission to start a revolution.
Yeah.
And what they did is they sat down in their Sunday best and out-polited the Southern white folks. Southern white folks pride themselves on politeness. And here were young African-American, intelligent, highly educated young people out-politing.
When you look back on it, it's not only illogical, it's stupid. And
expensive.
Yes, and expensive for everybody involved. But to prove...
Two waiting rooms at the train station, four sets of bathrooms.
Yep.
Herman Thomas, you grew up in this. What was it like?
We ignored them, basically. At least I did. We had just... No, seriously. We had three water fountains in my hometown. We had one for blacks, one for whites, and one for Native Americans. And we drank off of all of them. Nobody ever said anything, but yeah.
they didn't taste different, did it?
Yeah, it tasted fine. We went to it didn't at one level it didn't. You know, we just in some instances we just ignored it. But I remember being able to go back to Bryson City after the sit-ins, and walk into Dent's Cafe, which was the place everybody wanted to go. I walked right in the front, sat down at the counter, and served me. They served me. Then I politely took my cup and my food and went back to the back and began to talk to the black folk who were sitting in the back there eating. Mm.
To prove how ridiculous this was, Franklin McCain gave Steve Crump an example of what happened with other dark-skinned people who happened to dress up in robes and turbans. They weren't identified by the white people as American Negroes, and they got service at the same lunch counter.
On a couple occasions, we had some people to wrap themselves up in turbans and robes and go in and ask for service. Some people who looked just like me, except they had a turban and a robe on, and ask for service. And without hesitation at all, they were served immediately, no problem whatsoever. In fact, the last person who did that took his turban off and took his robe off right at the counter after he finished eating and sat down and asked for more service and was promptly denied.
Reverend Woods, you say that those students who participated in that and other sit-ins here and around the country were proving that, and I quote you, Black Lives Matter, and they forced America to come to terms with that. Was it that? Or was it that Americans saw this unfolding on their black and white television screens and they saw the violence in Selma and they saw the absolutely undeniable unfair treatment? Sometimes the facts get in the way of African Americans at the hands of police and other white citizens being spit on just for walking down the street and being hit with billy clubs and attacked by dogs. Which was it that had the greater impact on America, do you think?
Well, I think seeing the violence clearly on the TV screen had a major impact. And this is the South, and this is the Bible Belt. And those religious sensibilities, I think, began to kick in to some degree, and people start raising serious questions about treating people this way, and particularly treating young people and children this way. I don't know if those sensibilities would have kicked in if the South did not have this strong religious rooting or foundation. I think that was what mattered. I think the absence of that in other places around the world is one of the reasons that some of those efforts like this are so easily crushed. But those religious sensibilities, I think, were a huge part.
Mr. McCain died a few years ago, but you had a chance to speak to him before that. Obviously, that's why he appears in the film. And you also spoke with civil rights pioneer John Lewis, who tell a lot of stories that many people don't know, and they were there on the ground when it happened. They were the first wave of people in this. And you worked... You've talked to a lot of people in the course of doing these documentaries over a long period of time. But you worked on these two from a hospital bed.
Set up in our home, yeah.
Do you feel a sense of urgency to get these done with the people who are remaining with us because they are the first phalanx and they are the first person voices and now's the time, otherwise we're going to run out of time?
I think Mikey nailed it. The reality is, I just ask my wife, I have this bad habit of being a pack rat, which means I've saved all my raw interviews. And I was sitting back, latter part of the summer, early fall, realizing on the, not necessarily the civil rights timeline, but the calendar itself, that, gosh, February 1st, 2020 will be 60 years. I did a 50-year piece. And it was one of those things of where what you'll see are some clips that appeared in some other shows. But there was a lot of stuff, and Mike, you know this from having worked in television, there was a lot of stuff that ended up on the cutting room floor that we never got to use that happened to be relevant to what it is we're talking about.
Right.
So we were able to kind of craft that together and make not one, but two separate projects.
That first day, February 1st, 1960, the first day these four guys walked in there and sat down at that lunch counter. I'm sure that Woolworth's management didn't know what was hitting them because they hadn't anticipated this. It hadn't been done before, and here these guys sitting there, and they're not going anywhere. Why was it nonviolent? Why weren't they yanked out of there by the scruff of their neck?
Well, I think the element of surprise was most visible.
But then you kept coming back.
But it was a continuous presence. Uh-huh. That made the difference. I can tell you this: there were lines of persons who had gone through nonviolent training, waiting outside of Woolworths down the street for shifts to change, so that you did not have a person who just sat there continually. Mm-hmm. It was changed.
Well, why did they let you in? I mean, they knew what you were up to. You're standing outside the door. There were people sitting at the lunch counter.
I don't think there was anything else they could do because they didn't know what to do at the time because there was no violation of people being in the building.
I don't know if this is true, but I read yesterday that one of the reasons it was peaceful is that a white businessman kind of knew this was coming in advance, and before they could call the cops on you, he alerted the media, and nobody wanted bad media coverage.
I don't know about that.
Mike, let me just jump in for a moment.
Sure.
And that is in the grand scheme of what we've seen in the civil rights movement in this state. And Franklin in the piece makes a great point, which was the city fathers in Greensboro did not want bad press. Now, when you look at what happened in places like, and Ricky brings this up as well, with Emmett Till 5 years before in Money, Mississippi. We saw Bull Connor and how that played out in Birmingham. And the reality is here in Charlotte, going through that, going through what we, you know, in North Carolina, going through the sit-ins, going through what we saw 3 years earlier with Dorothy Counts, we didn't see any major eruptions of any kind of violence that would bring bad national attention. And what Frank said is that the city fathers in Greensboro did not want to have that kind of blemish.
Well, let's hear his words, because I've got that cut from that documentary, and his story, the Greensboro story, is not unlike the Charlotte story.
The city fathers in Greensboro were not necessarily concerned with my rights or me achieving my rights. They didn't want their precious town to have a blemish or a bad name.
Mm-hmm. Why? Greensboro, Charlotte, same philosophy. They didn't want the town to get a bad name. Selma, Montgomery, not so much. Why?
The Upper South here in the Carolinas was really poised for economic takeoff. And older parts of the South, even Atlanta, but also Selma, were, I think, more self-assured that their way of life would always prevail. Here, towns like Greensboro, especially Charlotte, were so busy reinventing themselves that I think there was a little bit more space. But it took so long. You talked about the first day, the second day, the first week. How long did it take?
Well, it took us several months before we achieved desegregation in Greensboro. Many other larger cities had already achieved that objective. And so we were continually demonstrating, and I think it was partly because they were attempting to punish us for having undertaken that exercise.
Here in Charlotte, it was not till summer, you know, month after month after month.
So when it happened, when they finally said, yes, you can eat at the lunch counter, no problem, did they make a big do out of it? Did they change the signs? Did they open the doors and have a sale? What did they do? How did they treat you?
I don't know.
A sit-in sale.
We actually didn't go in the store that much after that. But we did go, and it was nice reception. You know, we received nicely. But there was no big fanfare about, now we can go eat at Woolworth's. You just did it.
And then you found
other sites that needed the same kind of attention to which you directed your efforts.
The sit-ins in Charlotte were also, we had a few, right?
Oh, yeah, month after month after month.
And they were peaceful, correct?
Yeah.
Yes. And integration happened in Charlotte before it happened in Greensboro by at least a month.
Yeah, and I think you've been on this program, Tom, in the past to tell this story, that it happened peacefully here in cooperation with a lot of white business people who knew that they didn't want this stain on Charlotte, so they deliberately invited African-American leaders to join them for lunch at traditionally white-only restaurants. And what could the restaurateur say?
That was 1963. The lunch counters here desegregated in 1960, but those were kind of the people's restaurants. The white tablecloth restaurants, the movie theaters, they did not desegregate. And in 1963, Reginald Hawkins, who was a civil rights leader here, a dentist, led a protest down to Mayor Stan Brookshire's office and said it was time for things to change. And it happened to be the same time that the fire hoses and the police dogs were being called out in Birmingham. And Brookshire enlisted the Chamber of Commerce and said, we're going to go eat lunch two by two. And it did work. But how long it took for something so simple continues to...
Well,
just
you say months, but I'll bet you others would say 600 years.
Yeah.
So, yeah. What was my question going to be? You said that cities that didn't do it this way, cities that resisted this change,
right,
did worse than the cities that did do it. were you talking about contemporaneously? In other words, they did worse at the time, or had they never recovered?
I've been to Selma a couple of times on civil rights tours, and Selma is a time capsule. Selma appears never to have had any economic anything since that moment when John Lewis walked across the Edmund Pettus Bridge.
Yeah.
It's really amazing. Charlotte took off economically. Birmingham has struggled economically, and I can't link those directly there. I can tell you, though, that this movement that Franklin McCain started with the students spread not just through the Carolinas, but across the United States. There were something like 55 other cities yep. where there were sit-ins. And then at Levine Museum of the New South, folks come, and we've recreated the lunch counter there. We have these videos with McCain and others. And one day we had a group of high school students from Italy. And their teacher got to the sit-in area and started to have this emotional reaction. And I thought, you know, maybe it's jet lag or maybe it's something she'd... And I said, are you okay? And she said, yes. But we sat in Italy in sympathy in 1960.
Mm. Wow.
In Italy.
People who are pioneers, I don't care whether they're pushing west with a wagon train or they're going into outer space or they're sitting at a lunch counter in Grant, they don't think of themselves as pioneers. I'm sure you've been called that, Dr. Thomas. So when did you first realize that you were?
Well, I'm not sure I have.
I'm
yet.
Telling you that you are.
I think it was just the logical and expected thing for us to do. At the time, we had just gotten a new president of the college, mm-hmm. and Dr. Proctor. And the outgoing president did not offer any resistance or any advice. We just simply said, it's time for us to make a move forward. And I don't think of myself as a pioneer. It's just the next expected thing one has to do. I go back to the time when I was in the fifth grade, and I know this is going back further than you might desire, but in the fifth grade, in my own hometown, we exchanged schools, elementary schools, with the white school. Black teacher, white teachers, we went to their school, they came to ours. This was in the early 50s, 51. And so when the Supreme Court decision came down in 55, we had already been exchanging. We weren't going to the same classes, but we were exchanging with the white schools in our city. That was by the instruction of our teacher and the superintendent and the principal of the other schools. So I think it's just ingrained into your being that the next step is not just to exchange, but to actually desegregate.
We're going to hear some more stories of this time period, particularly in Greensboro and in Rock Hill, because there were sit-ins in Rock Hill that we'll talk about. And I also want to talk to Dr. Woods about, because not everybody has the courage or the tenacity or whatever it is to do this, the gumption. What about their character? It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Steve Crump is with us, documentarian. You know him from his work on WBTV and numerous documentaries, two new ones coming out at the end of this month, Franklin McCain, Flashbacks and Observations from a Civil Rights Trailblazer, and John Lewis, Reflections of a Sit-In Pioneer, which will be on WBTV and on Bounce at the end of the month. We'll put all the airtimes up on our website at WFAE.org. Dr. Herman Thomas is here, one of the organizers and a participant in the Greensboro sit-ins, which is what we're talking about. Tom Hanchett, historian at large at the Carolina Room in the Public Library, and Reverend Ricky Woods, a former student at North Carolina A&T and now the senior minister at First Baptist Church West. You did okay for yourself. Let's talk about these pioneers, because a lot of people don't do this. Even when they see people sitting at the lunch counter in 1960, they may not want to get involved, even though it would be in their interest to be, because it was dangerous.
It was
very dangerous. Talk about the character of people who have that kind of courage, who will put their own personal safety at risk for a greater cause.
Well, it was a different time, Mike.
The same, there are things you could do today that would.
Yeah, there are. But I think also keep in mind this is post Jackie Robinson. It's post Jackie Robinson. It's post Brown versus Board of Education. And during that era, there were certain things and conversations that African-American parents were having with their children. We hear a lot now about the conversation that parents had with their police, about the police and police interactions. But before those conversations, there were conversations around what you were expected to do to help change the world as a young person. Okay. You're going to have opportunities that your mom and dad did not have, and you're going to need to step up to the plate and take advantage of them. And so those kinds of conversations, they're going on in homes, they're going on in churches, in communities, so that by the time these young people get to college, they know that there's an entire community that is invested in them, and when the opportunity presented themselves, that they would have stepped forward. But they also stepped forward knowing that they had the backing of the community. They were not afraid about any backlash about the college expelling them or their parents being disappointed in them. It became a badge of courage.
Because these happened, these grew out of HBCUs.
Exactly. And so you had pockets where this courage is actually being sown into these young people so that by the time the opportunity presented itself, they were prepared to do so. It's almost like the military.
Yeah.
You prepare and train. You don't expect to be a hero, but when the moment presents itself, your training kicks in. And that's what had happened with these young people.
Steve, you had a chance to talk to a lady by the name of Betty Hobson Lundy.
Betty Hobson Lundy.
Excuse me. I'm going to play a piece of that tape first, and then I want to have you comment on
it's
it.
It's a great story.
She has a story of again, to point out how ridiculous all of this was. She was light-skinned, and she had a friend who was also light-skinned, as they used to say they could pass.
Mm-hmm.
And they went to have lunch, sit down, at Ivy's downtown, which was a department store that had a lunch room or a tea room.
Yeah, a restaurant, yeah.
Yeah, and they were served, and they had lunch. Here's her story.
Just walked right in, and nothing was said. He was so busy, you know, watching for people of color, you know. And we went in and sat down, and the waitress was very congenial, and you know, she kept coming to us, you know, or is everything all right? You know, just as you would now, you know, when you go in a restaurant. And underneath the table, my legs were trembling, you know, because I didn't know at what point somebody was going to come to us and say, you know, leave, you know. So we sat there for about an hour. And after that, we went out and joined the picket line. And, wow, you should have seen the expression on the, you know, the people that served us and the other whites that were in there, you know, they couldn't believe what had just happened.
This is right across the street from where we're sitting right now.
Yes.
We heard Franklin Graham talk about the turban story. We heard
Franklin McCain.
Franklin, excuse me. Yes, and Franklin McCain.
Difference.
About the turban, it's big difference. Turban story and Ms. Lundy talk about her Ivy story. Did these things happen a lot, trying to fool white people?
That ended up becoming a national story in one of the billboard newspapers for African-Americans, the Pittsburgh Courier. And the male student that she was with, his name was Thomas Wright. And you go back and you look at their, you know, yearbook photos, as the saying in the hood goes, gosh, these folks are so bright, they damn near white.
What were we thinking? One of the things that made this Greensboro sit-in so important, and we've said this before, is that it set the stage for things like this to occur all over the country. I think you said, what, it was 55?
54. There had been a sit-in in Charlotte. There had been scattered other ones, but none of them caught fire. And the way that they moved through the HBCU network here in this part of the South, then that inspired the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
Right. Mm-hmm. Of which John Lewis was one of the founders. Other cities noticed, took up this approach to nonviolent protest. And in your second documentary, the John Lewis documentary, John Lewis talks about that.
The sit-in spread all across the South like wildfire. It was like a snowball. It just kept rolling. And who's next? What city? Atlanta, Jackson, Mississippi, Chattanooga, Tennessee, Memphis, Tennessee, Greenville, South Carolina, Rock Hill, South Carolina. And the first mass arrest occurred near the end of February. Became the first mass arrest of students. I got arrested the first time.
You look at his facial expression, he wears that like a badge of honor. And I'm curious about this because his experience at these sit-ins and some of the things he did as a freedom rider were completely the opposite of what happened in Greensboro. He was beaten savagely in Selma on television, John Lewis was, and yet he kept coming back, and others kept coming back. How do you explain that, Steve?
I think with a lot of analysis. You know, he was a student at American Bible College in Nashville, Baptist College, I believe it is. And, you know, he was one of Dr. King's lieutenants, you know, along with Andrew Young, Hosea Williams, a lot of the other folks. And he held those nonviolent values to heart. And I think if you believe in something so strong, you tend to live it out for all to see.
In that second documentary that's coming out this month, John Lewis, Reflections of a Sit-In Pioneer. In that documentary, he talks about the experience of sitting at lunch counters and being spit on and beaten up. And later you have a clip of him speaking on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, exhorting people in the audience, young people, to make a difference and telling them that in his day they didn't have any modern tools. They had no social media. They didn't have a fax machine. He says, we just got in the way. What were some of the other ways that John Lewis just got in the way?
I think you pretty much nailed it. You know, the sit-in movement, voting rights in Selma, Alabama. He demonstrated against apartheid in South Africa. You know, John Lewis, like Charles Jones, who we talked about earlier, had been arrested a number of times. And that, Ricky calls it a badge of courage. I'd call it a badge of honor.
Mm-hmm. Well, he helped set the stage for something that became a pattern in the civil rights movement. I think, and maybe I'm wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, please. In Rock Hill, when he got arrested as a freedom rider, others did too, and they chose not to make bail. They could have, chose not to make bail, so that they could sit in the jail and the county would feed them and take care of them on their dime. And that's an approach that became kind of...
You're talking about jail, no bail.
Yeah.
And what occurred, and this is, you talk about the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, better known as SNCC. And they figured it out that these towns, and keep in mind, $100 fine in 1961, and they're taking in thousands of dollars from disruptive college students. Oh, it became a cash cow for them in that regard. So with their courage, they turned it around and turned the tables on the state.
And let them pick up the bill.
Yeah. And but another key thing
in Rock
Hill.
It was still jail. It was still jail.
It was still jail a hard time.
That's an important point to remember.
And chain gangs.
Yes.
And chain gangs. That was not pleasant.
Right.
Lewis was one of the key people organizing the Freedom Ride in May of 1961, which came right by the studio we're sitting in. The buses were supposedly desegregated, but they really weren't. And so white college students, black college students got on a bus, in a public bus, you know, in Washington, D.C., rode down to Charlotte. First time anybody was arrested was here in Charlotte. And then they got back on the bus and went down to Rock Hill, and John Lewis was beaten at the Rock Hill bus station.
Yeah.
This is 1961.
Yeah, his experience was very different from the Friendship Nine, who had a similar sit-in experience at the McCrory's in Rock Hill, which was still there until a couple of years ago. It may still be there, but I think it's
closed. A restaurant. It's gone through several gyrations.
The building and the counter are still there.
But his experience was very different when he arrived in Rock Hill, as you just said.
I remember in 1961 coming to Rock Hill and getting off a Greyhound bus at the Greyhound bus station to test a decision of the United States Supreme Court banning segregation in places of public transportation. My seatmate, a young white gentleman, the two of us tried to enter the so-called white waiting room, and we started in the doorway, and we were attacked and beaten and left lying in a pool of blood. That was my introduction to Rock Hill. I think my experience in Rock Hill prepared me for Bloody Sunday. It prepared me for what I faced in Montgomery at the Greyhound bus station there just a few weeks later.
I think he was the first person beaten at the bus station in Rock Hill, but just a few weeks later he was back again at it on another Freedom Ride, testing whether, because there was a federal law at the time that said in transportation facilities and in the
interstate commerce
transportation, there had to be equal treatment. And in the South, they just ignored that law. And this was coming just shortly after, I mean, lynchings were still going on. And Emmett
yes.
Till was five years before the Greensboro sit-ins. With that as backdrop, explain that. Talk about this engaging activity when you have people being killed left and right during the civil rights movement.
I think part of it is that people had shedded themselves of their fear. Terror only works as long as a community is afraid. And the community had finally gotten to a point where they would no longer allow themselves to be controlled by fear. And whatever happens, happens. And so that there are people who are willing to make sacrifices. Unfortunately, there are far too many who did make the ultimate sacrifice. But it was those kinds of things that ultimately opened up the door, and the country came to understand we can no longer survive as a nation like this. Something has to be done.
The Greensboro Four, John Lewis, countless others left behind this legacy, the value of which cannot be calculated because it's priceless. One of those people was Charlotte's own late Charles Jones, a civil rights activist, another of the founding members of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And on the 40th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, he appeared on this program with you at the Gateway Center, Steve. And he spoke about a legacy of things, or leaving a legacy of things that mattered.
When you get to be 68 and have survived the worst and best, you start looking back, wanting to sit down a little bit and rest and wonder about the younger folks. One of the things we had an understanding about when we were going into Mississippi was that if one of us didn't make it, the other would tell the story. So I want to recognize Brother Crump, Steve, who's telling the story, and that young brother who called in. Now, y'all get it together. We didn't hand you a gift that is golden itself. Now, don't make me have to come up in here and while you sit down talking about your latte and your date. Don't make me, as the ancestors and elders, come up in you and tell you to get off your tub and stand up and be counted. And what you gonna leave? What legacy are you gonna leave for your children?
These documentaries, as he pointed out, are your legacy, Steve. You're telling the story.
How many zeros would you like in that check I'm gonna write you, Mike?
Is that how you see your work?
You know, it's hard to define because I think you're so much in the moment when you're writing, producing, that you don't have an opportunity to process what they mean. You just get it done and move on.
Yeah. Too modest, Steve. Dr. Thomas, one of the things that John Lewis fought for years is what you fought for as a sit-in person and have fought in other areas your whole life. I think John Lewis felt that we might be sliding back with recent changes at the Supreme Court and pushes by various political entities. Are we?
To a large extent, yes. But I think it's the spirit of the American African American that is going to dominate, and I think that's what's dominated over the years. You cannot kill a spirit of revolution. You can only postpone the inevitability that it's going to take effect. So I think what we're experiencing now is a low point in the experience of African Americans in particular, but of Americans in general. There is not a sense of looking to the future. We're simply trying to preserve the present. And when you do that, you're on the you're in danger of becoming extinct, if not irrelevant.
Dr. Herman Thomas, organizer and participant in the Greensboro Citizens and a professor emeritus at UNC Charlotte. Tom Hanchett, historian at large at the Carolina Room of the Public Library. Ricky Woods, Reverend Ricky Woods, senior minister at First Baptist Church West. And Steve Crump, whose documentary Franklin McCain and John Lewis will air shortly. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.